The Old Testament, the book of Judges, chapter 5. This is Deborah's poem and song, although several lines may not be hers. It is in the usual Hebrew form of poetry, in couplets, with the second line either repeating the point of the first line or adding to it. Occasionally there is a triplet. It is said this poem to be one of the finest odes of triumph preserved in Israelite literature. It has a vigor and a vividness which could only have come from an eyewitness. The poem may have been included in one of two anthologies mentioned, both of them mentioned in Scripture, the Wars of the Lord referred to in Numbers 21 and 14, or the Book of Jasher, referred to both in Joshua 10:13 and 2 Samuel 1:18. And the rhythm or the meter of the poem has mostly three beats or four to a line, although this rhythm is completely obscured in the authorized version, but is brought out in modern translations such as the New International Version. The first verse is obviously introductory by some editor, telling us what the poem is about. The first line of verse 2 is obscure and could refer to the long lock of Israel's hair, the hair of the warriors, since it was apparently the practice of Israelite soldiers going to battle to refrain from cutting their hair as a vow and a sign that they were intent upon holy war. And this, of course, as an expression of the complete dedication of the warriors under Deborah and Barak. Verse 3 goes on to summon heathen kings and rulers, and although Jabin is not mentioned in the poem, Sisera is. These kings are to listen to the music of the song being sung, which is praising the Lord for the victory he has given. And of course, as you have seen in the reading of the poem, there is a high degree of inspiration in it. The poem would make a glorious oratorio. Then the Lord himself is addressed at verse 4, in terms which can be confusing. Ask this question. Did you ask it while you were reading? Why has Edom and Seir, away to the south of the Dead Sea, what has Edom and Seir got to do with this action which took place in the north of the land? There seems to be a collocation of different events here, namely the earthquaking, apparently at Sinai, at the giving of the law. You read of that, you remember, in Exodus chapters 19 and 20. And either the 12 spies going up from Kadesh Barnea in their first brave march into the territory of Canaan, or even the forced, you remember, the forced circuitous march Israel had to make because Edom, brother Esau, would not let them pass through his territory. But as is usual in later Old Testament poetry, as in the Psalms, there is abundant reference back to the deliverance of the Exodus and God's mighty arm guiding Israel through their desert wanderings and guiding them through them victoriously. And so here, the same spirit and the same sense of triumph. On these later events also, there were phenomenal manifestations of nature to assist the Lord's people in their battles. The clouds of verse 4 are particularly apt, because you remember from chapter 4 that we read a fortnight ago, because of the cloudburst which bogged down Sisera's chariot and won Israel the war. And although there are none of these naturalistic accompaniments to the exciting events of our day, in 1989 and 90 and 91, we feel that the gigantic overthrow of a totalitarian regime across the face of Europe was so sudden and dramatic as to warrant a description in comparison with these ancient events. That is to say, if the God of Israel is also the God of the Christians today, which is surely the case, we see the same spirit and should express our gratitude to God in the same spirit as these poets and poetesses did long ago. If not, then the Lord may not be so ready to give us victories in the future. But whether in reference to ancient or modern events, this is what we were singing in Psalm 78, verse 65, last Saturday evening. Then the Lord awoke us from a sleep, as a man wakes from the stupor of wine, says the writer, daring to charge the Lord with such a spirit. The Lord awoke us from a sleep, as a man wakens from the stupor of wine, and beats back his enemies and puts them to everlasting shame. Then Shamgar is again briefly mentioned, you notice, because he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Kundal, the commentator, says the ox goad was a formidable weapon, long-handled, 8 to 10 feet long, tipped with metal, and when sharpened would have the qualities of a sword. But it's the bravery of the action which is extolled here, reminding us of Samson with his jawbone of an ass, or David with Goliath and his few pebble stones, and Jael, of course, but more of her later. But why in verse 6 were the roads abandoned and travelers took to winding paths? And the answer must be, surely because the land was virtually in the hands of Sisera's bandits. Village life. Or should the translation be traveling caravans had ceased, and the whole land was put to ransom to such an extent that Deborah could stand it no longer. Perhaps she had waited too long for some man to arise and say, "Enough!" And when no one did, as may have been the case some years ago with regard to a certain Margaret, she acted. Good for her. A mother in Israel? But she sounds more like a great striding he-woman buckling on her armor, Joan of Arc. And it's certainly enough to put men to shame. But you see, Israel had turned their backs on the Lord and had chosen some of the gods of the Canaanites. They could hardly expect the pagan worshippers of these gods not to see this as a complete capitulation to them, and thus harry them, deprive them of their weapons, and herd them into their cities and villages like cattle, prisoners of the people they had been commanded to liquidate. What a lesson is here for us about procrastination with regard to the destruction of evils in the midst. What a lesson. Evils, like rust and rot, increase with time. Cancers seldom abate and dry up and die. They grow, as do other evils. So the woman summoned the warriors, whether they had weapons or not. And so she now sings, after the battle, she now sings of the willing ones who came forward to the battle. For who rises in an emergency and sees public response to his call or her call is not glad and bound to praise the Lord as this woman does. Verses 10 and 11 are intriguing. There is a stirring and a mustering of forces, and ordinary wayfarers traveling by donkey or on foot are bid consider what is happening at the four gathering points, usually at the wells and watering places. So, to encourage themselves, as they waited for the others to arrive at these gathering points, they sang. There seems to have been a spontaneous response that came from the Lord, of course, a spontaneous response of the people, because the Lord had arisen and had awakened out of his sleep, and the warriors were constrained to converge on the recruiting and mustering places. The whole of these northern tribes had been galvanized into action because this prophetess woman had arisen. There they sang the songs of Israel's former triumphs. The deliverance from Egypt and the crossing the Red Sea through the wilderness. And it is as if they are waking Deborah, not she them. And so they shouted, "Wake, Deborah, get up, Barak. The Lord is on your side. Rise and take your captive." And so there is described in the poem a great mustering of forces from further and further afield. You remember in chapter 4, it was principally Zebulun and Naphtali who responded, very likely because they had suffered the most from Sisera. But naturally, the people of Ephraim were affected by Deborah's presence among them. That's where she dwelt, under the palm tree. And the reference to Amalek, did you notice that and wonder about it? Is thought not to refer to Israel's sworn enemy, Amalek, grandson of Esau. But the line calling for retranslation, as with the Barclay Bible, and the Revised New English Bible, and the Revised Standard Version, seems to suggest that it refers to the growing army descending into the valley, Benjamin from even further south following. And Machir generally refers to Manasseh beyond Jordan, but here very likely refers to the western Manassehites. They certainly sent leaders or captains, as it says, as did Zebulun and Issachar. Look at the map of the distribution of these northern tribes and see how widespread as well as eager was the response to Deborah's call. It is wonderful. And in striking contrast, what was happening to Israel beyond Jordan? Israel out of the land. Is Israel out of the land, out of the place of blessing? Any believers here tonight, out of the land, out of the place of blessing? Had these Reubenites forgotten what Moses said to them and to the Gadites about deserting their brethren because they had found salubrious pasture, like Lot, you remember, out of the land on that eastern side of Jordan, which wasn't Canaan at all, or Israel at all, and isn't today? This is what Moses said to Reuben then. Shall your countrymen go to the war while you sit here? Why do you discourage the Israelites from going over into the land, the land that the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea. And here you are a brood of sinners standing in the place of your fathers and making the Lord even more angry with Israel. If you turn away from following him, he will again leave all this people in the desert. And you will be the cause of their destruction, says Moses. And so, in those days, the 2.5 tribes remaining beyond Jordan promised to send their warriors to help the other tribes subdue the land. And then they would return to their own chosen territory. But not so now. There was great searching of heart. Aye, of course, and there always is. There always is great searching of heart, and a good deal of misery when we balk at what is apparently the Lord's will. It's not a happy experience, however much we fear to step out and do what he says. It's not a happy experience. How much time and thought, how much emotional and mental energy is wastefully expended by us speculating upon what is to the Lord as plain as a pikestaff. Natural disinclination so churns up the emotions that it ultimately becomes the specious reason for not going and not doing what the Lord has commanded. It is a sad day when our like likes and dislikes, our emotional reactions to things from the Lord are elevated into arguments against the Lord's will and way. We are very far astray by that time, and would be quite capable of argument in that spirit that black is white and white is black. One of the greatest responsibilities of a Christian counselor is to see that those who seek help and guidance are vitally in touch with the Lord and His will. Who can tell them but He the way to go? Counselors can't, parents can't, pastors can't, no one can but the Lord. And He will. Oh, this has to be said over and over again. One is saying something like this almost every day of one's life. Said it to Dennis this morning after the service. The Lord will show you the way to go. He cannot fail. We used to sing a chorus like that, I think. He cannot fail, for He is God. Patience we need in our uncertainty. Is it this way, or is it that way? Or is it this way now or later on? Or that way now or later on? Oh yes, all that. And that can be costly. But not so costly as taking the wrong way and precipitating ourselves into a situation that He never intended us to be in at all. Oh, how important, friends, young folk, how vastly important is divine guidance. And after many years and looking back through the years of marriages between 40 and 50 years, one sees how important it is that we know the Lord's will. So not only all Gilead stayed away, but Dan, still in their original southern territory, if you know the geography of the placing of the tribes. They stayed away also, doubtless too harried by their Canaanite neighbors. The Canaanite neighbors refused to let them get down to the Mediterranean, to the shore, you see, and too afraid to assault them, as the Lord had commanded them to deal with them. Far too afraid to assault the Canaanites. And so they took the line of least resistance, until in a later day, you remember, desperate for outlet, they fled to and stole territory in the far north, in which to dwell, from Dan to Beersheba. Asher was apparently in the same boat and is preoccupied with coping with her Canaanite neighbors, all of whom should have been wiped out. So she couldn't come. See chapter 1, verse 31 for that. So although although there was a brave mustering from various sources, it was Zebulun and Naphtali who took the major part of the strain of the battle, and so the battle was joined. Now we are to see what the Lord will do. And of course, you see, the thing is that when the Lord's people go out to battle, their forces must muster as if they were to do it all by themselves, and depending only upon the Lord's inspiration, rising to the situation and routing their enemies. You see, but how often in these Old Testament battles a supernatural element turns out to be the decisive factor in the situation. Almost always. Find how many battles of the Lord in the Old Testament were only battles of weapons, of war. And how many had supernatural elements of weather or whatever introduced to them? Some demonic interference. I think, you know, of Jehoshaphat's great victory over his southern foes in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. What a chapter is that? 2 Chronicles 20. Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, was told that the battle was not his, but was the Lord's. But of course they still had to sally forth. And the Lord said, take up your positions, stand firm, and see the deliverance of the Lord. And so, the singing priests and Levites, the choir, were set in front of the army. And off they went, singing their songs, to find that the Lord had set an ambush against their enemies. And so the different nations involved in the evil alliance of Edomites and Moabites and Amorites too rose up and fought each other to their mutual destruction. And Israel stood amazed, open-mouthed, to see what the Lord did. Not a sword was wielded. Not their swords, anyway. Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that wonderful? That's from heaven. As more things on earth are from heaven than I think we've realized. Oh, we need to read heaven in our newspapers and on our screens. There's more of heaven in the news. There's lots of hell, of course, we know. No doubt about that. But there's more of heaven in the news from time to time than we may see. God, open our eyes to see it. So here at verse 19, kings came, the kings of Canaan. Kings of Canaan, the Lord in heaven might have been saying, there ought to have been no kings of Canaan by this time. Why are they still there and alive? But they came, and they fought at Taanach, by the waters of Megiddo. But they carried away, says the poem, no silver, no plunder. Why not? Because the God of heaven who rules the earth from the heavens, whether we think of the stars here as natural stars, or as representing angelic beings, like Daniel, you know, in chapter 10, where the angelic and the demonic forces are joined in heavenly combat. The battle in the heavens is determined. Determines, rather. The battle in the heavens determines what will happen on the earth. And that is, of course, according to Ephesians 6 and 12. You remember the verse? Oh, don't forget that verse. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Oh, that would do for a heading of a study on the battles of the Lord in the Old Testament, wouldn't it? What a fine superscription for a study that some of you divinity chaps could do sometime. Better than some of the things you do. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. That's what the battle of prayer is about. Sisera, you see, Sisera. Sisera hadn't a ghost of a chance. Any more than the forces of Baal had a chance later on Mount Carmel, because God stepped in both cases, and by floods of water from the heavens, God gave victory. So the cloud burst, you see, flooded the Kishon, that dried up river bed. I never saw any river bed, not even Kidron, under Jerusalem, as dried up as Kishon was. Flooded the river Kishon and swept the enemy away, one way or another. And you see, the poetess, thinking of the Lord's heavenly advantage up there, you know, with his heavenly helicopters, reconnaissance all the time, with the clouds of heaven at his disposal, he doesn't need swords, seems to bid the Israelite troops march on, regardless of the storm, and ride on into it, and use it, since the initiative was with them, because the initiative was with their Lord. You see, if you are with the Lord, and obeying the Lord, and walking in the Lord's ways, his initiative becomes your initiative, as you obey him. Go on to victory, the Lord's victory, not yours. Ah, but you have to effect it. You have to enact it. Having been given every advantage, as these were, of the awful weather. Where Meroz is, I mean the district and its people, verse 23, a bitter curse is venged on them for refusing to be part of such a God-given victory. You don't opt out of the Lord's will and plans for nothing. Not with impunity or immunity either. There are high prices to be paid for disobedience to the Lord's revealed will. High prices to be paid. It's like so many who are supposed to belong to our cause. They stand on the sidelines. They might offer pious or specious words of encouragement to us about the work we are doing, although they are just as capable in other company of saying contemptuous things, and do say contemptuous things when they get the chance. but they will have nothing to do with the battle. They are much too detached and self-controlled, not to say self-contained, to give way to such enthusiasm. This poem says, Meroz is to be cursed, and that's a terrible judgment on would-be, or is it really won't-be associates. I often think of scores of men I know or have known in the ministry who could easily be joined with the Creef Brotherhood to swell its ranks to many, many hundreds. But for reasons known or unknown to themselves, mostly slightly contemptuous or separatist, they stand on the sidelines. Even some who have belonged and have withdrawn from us are of that ilk. And I pity them. They refuse to commit themselves and prefer not to be associated with certain names. But what is that? What is that compared with the glorious sense of the Lord's presence among us when we worship and sing and pray together? Ah, but wait, the chief triumph here is not over these sorry Sizeran troops, although they, poor things, have had to abandon their bogged-down and immobilized chariots to squelch through the mud to their undoing. That's not the chief triumph of this poem. It is in the tent of jail, that the kingpin of evil, Sisera himself, who had bedeviled northern Israel for 20 years, lies asleep, having been refreshed with the milk of jail's human kindness, before she performed the coup de grace which settled the issue of the war by slaying the old spider himself in his web, by which she rendered his forces a tangled web of helpless soldiery at bay, fleeing for their lives, but destined to make the river Kishon run red into the Mediterranean with their pagan blood. Most blessed jail, Deborah calls her. But many, many yellow-livered pietists, so delicate with evil that they would nurse it and hope to turn it into something compassionate and good. Convert the devil, they would like to do. Are shocked at Deborah's rousing commendation of the woman. Oh, yes, they would like to convert the unconvertible devil and his crew. How utterly unrealistic are such sentimentalists in Christ's church. But, of course, we've gone over all that before, and spoken of the need for corporal and capital punishment. We wait to see the nation and its authorities learn, but we fear it will take greater evils yet to force the governments of our land, weakened by the philosophies of behaviorist psychology. Force them to dirty their hands in putting down the evils of our day and of tomorrow. And so we come to the last section of the poem, which is a lament by Sisera's mother for his non-appearance. I am reminded of Widow Jezebel, that odious one, appearing at the window of the palace at Jezreel, I think it was, to ask Jehu sarcastically if he came in peace. So Jehu, the rash and the ready, you remember, called to her eunuchs upstairs there to throw her down. And they did, spattering her blood on the walls and on the horses, so violent her death. So it is with your son, Mrs. Sisera, because Mrs. Sisera Senior, because he had harried and harassed God's chosen nation in their backslidden state for 20 long years. And a fearful thing is, you know, that those who wickedly take the sword, says Jesus, shall perish by the sword themselves. Although, on the other hand, the Apostle Paul says that the Lord's magistrate bears not the sword in vain. And we can only cry with Habakkuk, in the midst of God's judgments, Lord, I stand in awe of your deeds. In wrath, remember mercy. And of course, there is always that wonderful word in James 2:13, in which, when we are terrified by the judgments of God, and yet fear that the legitimate rulers of our land or of our church will not take heed to God's judgments and act upon them, when we tremble before God's judgments, we may find shelter and comfort in these wonderful words of James 2:13, not dishonoring God's holy law, as many New Testament scholars seek to do, despising the Old Testament and trying to set the New Testament in the air instead of upon its foundation. You remember what James' words are there? Mercy triumphs over judgment. What a mercy. What a mercy for us. Jesus' blood, what a mercy for us that it does triumph over judgment.